this gets back to strategy again. I think a well-formed strategy on what you want to do, what you need to do, and to stick with it. One of the coined phrases I've used for years is, and I'll use the EMS industry for example, is I would call it CM chasing, kind of like the storm chasers on the television. And it's actually very difficult to do. To my estimate, based on experience, it takes somewhere between 5 and 6 years or so, 5, 6, 7 years, to get an EMS provider producing the way that you want. The proverbial, feet up on your desk type of idea, where you're very comfortable, there's a lot of trust, you know exactly what they're doing, and they're an extension of the OEM. And if you keep moving around geography-wise or company to company-wise, you never get to that equilibrium, and you're constantly bringing up, training new people, new facilities, new equipment, the whole operation is always changing. So you're never in a comfortable position, as I would call it.
That's my guest, IPC's Matt Kelly, next on Reliability Matters.
Welcome to Reliability Matters, a podcast for the electronic assembly industry. Each episode covers topics related to reliability, best practices, and environmentally responsible assembly techniques, with insights from experts across the electronic assembly industry. Now, here's your host, Mike Conrad.
If you're in the electronic assembly industry, you've probably heard Matt Kelly speak at various technical conferences or read some of his technical papers. Matt worked with IBM for just under 15 years, holding several senior technology and engineering leadership positions within IBM's systems division. His technical contributions include 25 patents, 85 publications, and numerous industry awards. Matt recently joined IPC as their chief technologist, where he and his team will help IPC's members to engage in the latest technology trends and supply chain transformation that continues to evolve across the electronics industry. Matt's primary area of focus will be leading a Factory of the Future initiative, standards and technical research, industry knowledge funding, and creation and launch of an industry CTO council. Matt joined us from his home office in Toronto, Canada. Now, here's my conversation with Matt Kelly. Matt Kelly, welcome to Reliability Matters. Thanks for being my guest today.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
Yeah, my pleasure. You know, I have to share a story. The first time, I don't know if it was the first time I heard you speak, but a memorable time I heard you speak. You were keynoting at the, if memory serves, at the Cleaning and Coating Conference, the IPC/SMTA Cleaning and Coating Conference in Chicago. Do you remember that?
I do.
Okay, good. I'm getting that event right. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it is a cleaning and coating conference. I'll say that one more time. Cleaning and coating conference. And then literally the first words that came out of your mouth was, you know, Matt Kelly, I'm from IBM. And, you know, just so you know, we don't clean anything or something to that effect. And I remember thinking, like, what the hell did I just hear? I'm at a cleaning and coating conference, and our keynote is saying they don't clean anything. But then you gave this really interesting presentation about the computer system you were working on. And I don't know if it was Watson or some, you know, or whatever, but it was a, you know, uber expensive, very large computing system. And then you made the point that, you know, as I remember it anyway, I might have some of it wrong, that, you know, these are kind of like one at a time custom built, you know, machines, and they're not like mass produced, and you could engineer out the need to clean more than average mere mortals can. I think I got that takeaway right, but that was my first memorable experience of you speaking, and you pulled it off. You know, the first words were provocative, and then it was very interesting from that point on. Do you recall that particular episode?
I do, and I particularly remember the looks on people's face in that first 5 minutes. So I had to mention, you know, bear with me, folks, and there's some good reason why I said that. But
yeah, and then
you know, it was really well attended, and I think it also just shows that, you know, without getting into detail on that particular topic, it just shows that there's different ways and different approaches to attack a similar problem. So that's really the main message.
Well, you know, Maslow's theory, if all you have is a hammer, you see the world as a bed of nails. So, you know, if you're a cleaning company everything's dirty. Everything needs to be clean. But sometimes there are alternatives to that when you can control the own the whole process from start to finish. Well, congratulations on your new role at IPC.
Thank you. Yeah, it's been an interesting start. Who would have thought that about 5 weeks after I started the position, COVID would have taken over the world? But here we are.
Welcome to the party. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, jumping in at the deep end of the pool for sure. Before we get into your new role, I just want to go back in history a little bit. My understanding is you had a 14-year stint at IBM. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah, just shy of 15, it would have been in the spring. That's right.
And what were your primary responsibilities at IBM? I know that the outcome of those responsibilities resulted in, I believe, 25 patents. So you were quite busy there. But what was your primary responsibility over that nearly 15-year experience?
I was really fortunate to be able to be involved in several things. The design aspect of it, that includes, concept design. What type of system did we want to make? What new features, functionality did it have? And those sorts of things. So the design aspect is actually one of the areas that I finished in, making sure that our designs were as reliable and as robust as they could be. And most importantly, that our supply chain could help design and actually build it. So that was really very much my focus as I exited IBM. But I also got a chance to spend time learning the supply chain itself. And, of course, IBM, a very large company, really became immersed in the global supply chain and how that worked. So I think what I really learned in terms of a takeaway was the design through new product introduction into volume manufacturing. So that whole product life cycle of concept, digital designs, making machine number one, and ramping, to service demand. So I feel very fortunate that I was able to have that breadth of experience, as well making it what I call making it real, making it what really matters, and that's the execution and implementation of all of it. So the global supply chain aspects and insights that I gained over all those years are really, really helpful as I look forward here at IPC.
Excellent. And we're going to get into your new IPC role in just a few, but you actually gave me a perfect segue. A colleague and friend of mine brought this particular question up and assured me that this question was near and dear to your heart. So hopefully it's not a setup. You just talked about building machine number one and then kind of, ramping it into production. When it comes to new product introductions, how are companies handling the rollout of new products, taking them from a lab environment to a first article to scalable production, either here or more frequently in other countries? What are the risks, challenges, pitfalls of new product introductions, scaling, and transferring all that knowledge to frequently a third party, or at least a third party within the same company that's going to have to build this in production?
Great question. The short answer is communication. That's the number one thing that I've seen over the years. I mean, there's a lot of, we all have advanced degrees and we're doing, there's lots of complexity to these systems and there's never enough time. These are all very common business problems, but the number one thing I've learned is that it's communication. Communication comes in many, many forms. I use the analogy, I've used this for years, maybe I'll talk about it here, is I call it my pink house analogy. So I go away for the weekend and I need my house painted, and you're a great painter. So I say, Mike, here's a paintbrush. If you could have that painted for when I come back, that would be great. So I go off on my weekend and come back and you're standing there with the brush in your hand and you're ecstatic. You did a lot of work. It's very well done and the house is completely painted. So you've got a big smile on your face. And I'm standing there looking at my house, just aghast. What did you do to my house? And as we both turn around, we look and the house is bright pink. So my question is, who's wrong? Me not asking, or sorry, you not asking the question, what color do I want the house? And, you know, some of those details, or for me not telling you. So it's kind of a funny anecdotal story, but it really comes down to the grassroots of engineering. It's about specifying and requiring certain things for the product. And if you can do that right, then the cost, the quality, reliability, security, MPI cycle time, that trusted supply chain, then all of that comes to life.
Yeah, I have a real life experience, not a pink house, but similar. I was hired as an expert witness. My audience has heard this story before, so sorry for the redundancy here. But I was hired as an expert witness on a product failure due to contamination, calf and dendritic growth and things like that. And I represented the contract manufacturer side, and the OEM and the technology owner submitted a statement of work. And one of the descriptions of the board material, that they wanted the contract manufacturer to handle everything from board fab to final assembly and test and packaging and all that. And the description of in the statement of work for the board material was, and I quote, "down and dirty FR4, nothing special," unquote. And so you can imagine their mindset when you see, like, yeah, we really don't care, just something cheap. Right. Just get it done. That just echoed all through the statement of work. And although they got what they paid for, they got nothing special, FR4, harsh environment, had all sorts of issues with calf and other things. But they got what they paid for. The OEM sued the contract manufacturer for doing exactly what they told them to do. And they said the contract manufacturer should have known better and have corrected them, which probably is a valid point. But it was kind of the same thing. They ended up with a pink house, to use your analogy. And all the instructions were, as poor as the instructions were, they were followed. They were followed well based on a set of poor instructions. So they ended up getting a poor product. So, yeah, I share the communication. How much of that communication changes when it goes from small production to scalable large production? Is that a whole new level of communication? Do you see things in production that one doesn't see when they build a prototype or a first article?
Yes, certainly. The way I would describe it is that one builds upon the other. However, if you do it right, by the time you get to volume, most of the heavy lifting, at least from the technical do's and don'ts and all the core things like quality, reliability, all of that's already settled. That's the whole process of qualification, that you're making sure that you're doing things right up front. But, you know, there's different things that kick in, if you will, at volume. It becomes more fab and fulfillment, delivery, supply chain continuity. So, you know, the workload and the type of work that you're doing shifts over time. It becomes less I'll describe it as, it becomes less technical and more logistical. And so if you do that right, you know, you can keep your MPI time, cycle times down, because that's really what one of the key drivers is today. I mean, we just see, if you think about technology revisions, it's just unbelievable how fast things move. I've almost given up trying to keep up with things personally, you know, with your latest phone, because as soon as you have one, it's old. So, yeah, I think to answer the question, it's really about the type of work changes, but the rigor behind that and having it well laid out along that MPI, a very well laid out MPI process is key. Mm.
Switching gears a little bit. One of my former guests on the show was a sustainability engineer for IBM, and out of Ireland, if memory serves. And my question to you is, you talk a little bit about supply chain and all of that. Does sustainability live in the sustainability department, and do they kind of get in your way and say, you know, here rather than there or whatever, or in not necessarily just in the world of IBM, but just in your experience in general, Is sustainable supply chain management something that actually truly does flow down throughout an organization? Or is it just one, you know, crazy guy's department?
Well, again, if done right, I think that it does flow down. I mean, the one thing that was clear back with European Union RoHS legislation back in the early 2000s, for example, was that it was top-down. Legislation, if you can't ship a product into a geography, then that dictates everything. So for things like that, or there's conflict minerals and all kinds of different chemical bans inside of electronics, all of that needs to be well managed and understood. I must say too, though, that it's always very dynamic. There's a lot to it. When you involve chemistry, not a lot of people understand chemistry, or if you did, you've forgotten it from your school days. So there does need to be, to your point, a lot of focus put on sustainability up front, and then apply that to the operations as the cycle that I just described through design and MPI. So I think that's, you know, if you could write it on paper and have a textbook answer, that's what I would recommend.
Yeah, very good. Okay, let's talk about IPC. Tell me a little bit about your new role at IPC. Well, first of all, I think it is a new role, right? You didn't replace anybody. I think this is something that was created, and you're filling it. Am I accurate there?
Yes, that's right. This is a newly created position intended to increase the technical capability and voice of IPC. So working directly with John Mitchell and the executive staff to really help members engage in the latest technology advancements and the supply chain transformation that continues to evolve across the industry. So I work within the senior leadership team. We work every single day to define the right strategies, the right thought leadership up front to create, you know, the scope of future services or products to be developed by the association. And this spans, I know you've had the prior guest, John Mitchell, on the show as well. We talk about our pillars of, you know, standards, education, advocacy, and solutions. So I work within the solutions group and, you know, making sure that we're delivering value to the members across those pillars.
So what are some of the challenges that you see as IPC's chief technologist coming our way? I mean, obviously we're living in a challenging time right now. We'll get into the pandemic in a moment. Outside of that, you know, your welcome gift to IPC was a pandemic. Welcome to the organization. We're now in a pandemic. So, you know, that was ill-timed. But outside of the whole pandemic thing, what are some of the challenges that our industry is facing? You talk about technical advances. Anytime something changes, it's always challenging. What do you see as some of the challenges we need to overcome?
Who can remember before COVID, it seems these days, but it wasn't very, you know, it was very, very much in front of us as COVID hit, and that was the tariffs and trade wars that have been going on. We've seen a dramatic uptick in manufacturing regionalization across different countries. This is not just North American based. The UK is looking into things, the European Union as well. So I would say, you know, one of the biggest challenges that we're faced right now is this notion, and I don't know if this is the right way to describe it, but it's almost a reversal of this horizontal global supply chain that we've been touting for the last two decades. Build it wherever you can, cost is king, make sure you can have that supply chain working in your favor and produce your product. And, you know, the combination of tariffs and, you know, quite frankly, COVID now, these are two very, very strong driving forces why we're seeing manufacturing regionalization. And we know that you just can't pick up factories because you want to and, you know, circle the wagons and bring it within, you know, a trusted region. You can, but there's a cost. And the other question I bring up is do you need to do that? Should you do that? It goes back to what you were talking about at the beginning of the the conversation when I said, you know, back in my IBM days, you know, cleaning, we don't clean anything. There's different ways to approach the problem, and that's, you know, very, very much relevant here. So I think the manufacturing regionalization, along with a trusted supply chain, this is also a kind of a tandem concept that is, especially in the United States right now, that is really coming to the forefront, making sure that we have continuity of supply, you know, making sure we have delivery on time, security, quality, and reliability. So the trusted supply chain in a regionalized environment would be top of my list.
Yeah, interesting. I interviewed a guest. It was just the last episode. It just released yesterday. David Alexander. He's a China import-export guy, right? So you know, we talked earlier about Maslow's theory. You know, if you all you have is a hammer, you see everything as a bed of nails. He's a Chinese China import-export guy, so he sees everything being built in China. And he even said, you know, obviously we're talking about the pandemic and what are we learning from this and all that. And he said, look, if you're building, you know, 10,000 units a year, you have no business setting up a factory in China or anywhere else in the world. You know, that there's a threshold where it makes sense and there's a threshold where it just does not make sense. And with the risks and all of that, I won't recycle that, but there's a lot of risk when you outsource, particularly in certain countries. And, you know, he was, you know, just qualifying it like, no, there's a huge opportunity to build things in North America that, you know, we just are so knee-jerked into, you know, I have a product, I'm going to build it the cheapest place possible. And sometimes the cheapest place possible is actually the most expensive place possible when you go all in and factor everything. So it, it was an interesting look at supply chain and just the stereotype of a supply chain. You know, we come up with a new product and then we ship it to a country that pays the least and you know, build it for as low as possible. And that is not really the way it, it always works. Let's bring COVID into this conversation and talk about changes to the supply chain. My experience when I was watching and listening to the talking heads about supply chain, at first, when the pandemic first hit, it was, and China was shut down, you know, it was, we need a new supply chain. We need to reshore. We need to, you know, bring things, if not to North America, if not to the United States or Canada, you know, Mexico or Vietnam or someplace else. And then I heard the drumbeats change because China was one of the first countries to kind of get through it and reopen. And then it was like, well, thank God, you know, we're still in China. So I've seen it kind of pulse. What's your thought in terms of, are we learning anything? Is there something to be learned through this pandemic? And what kind of changes do you think will result from this experience and the supply chain disruption that we've seen all over the world?
This gets back to strategy again. I think a well-formed strategy on what you want to do, what you need to do, and to stick with it. One of the coin phrases I've used for years is, and I'll use the EMS industry, for example, is I would call it CM chasing, kind of like the storm chasers on the television. And it's actually very difficult to do. You know, to my estimate, based on experience, it takes somewhere between 5 and 6 years or so, 5, 6, 7 years to get an EMS provider producing the way that you want, the proverbial, you know, feet up on your desk type of idea where you're very comfortable. There's a lot of trust. You know exactly what they're doing and they're an extension of the OEM. And if you keep moving around geography wise or company to company wise, you never get to that equilibrium and you're constantly bringing up, training new people, new facilities, new equipment, just, you know, the whole operation is always changing. So you're never in a comfortable position, as I would call it. And so I think that, you know, back to the question of COVID, I think it's really just been an accelerant. Remember, tariffs before COVID hit were 25% plus of the product value. I mean, that is a very large tax. I mean, you have to cover 25% on your margins. So that means you better have good margins to begin with.
Sure.
So the, you know, COVID plus tariffs have really forced executive leadership teams to look at their strategy. And that's one of the things that, you know, from an IPC perspective, what we're doing right now is we're working with our members and, you know, within IPC as well, to really lay out the supply chain and marry that with the product, because the supply chain builds the product. So you have to map out what you're building, where it's built, and then bring in the questions, what are my risks or what are the things that I really care most about? And that could be a variety of things. You know, the number one thing, the you know, the concern of security or lack of security out there. I think that kind of bubbles up as top. You know, what if someone's spying on me or sharing my information? And that's absolutely a concern. But, you know, I would argue that there's a lot of other risks and concerns that are equally as important, like good old fashioned quality and reliability. I mean, if you, you know, need that device to work when it, you know, should, and it doesn't, then you've got issues. So, you know, you need to bring in this set of, you know, what are my risks? Is it continuity of supply? Could be a natural disaster. If you can't get parts, then you can't build. Deliveries, security, quality, and reliability. So I think layering the supply chain with the product type you're building and then going into strategic discussion, that's the way to hopefully mitigate some of this. And, you know, it sounds easy when I lay it out, but obviously there's a lot of challenges there, but at least it's a framework to begin to get through some of this.
Whenever there is a challenge, there also is an opportunity, depending upon, you know, how you look at it. Every challenge has an opportunity to create something that overcomes the challenge. And we're in pretty challenging times right now as an industry, as a society, really, with this pandemic. From your perspective and your experience, what are some of the opportunities that may not be here in normal times, or not as obvious in normal times? Do you see any unique opportunities in this pandemic era that are available for at least some manufacturers to exploit?
It's hard to believe that you can get excited during a COVID pandemic time like this, but I actually am. I think that, and history has shown this coming out of, you know, major disruptions in the past, that the companies that and the organizations that spend time on strategy and an implementable strategy come out of these disruptions even stronger than before. And, you know, maybe I'm an eternal optimist, but, you know, that's certainly what I believe. And so times like this, in a way, give you time to think and give time to go through that strategy when you may not have it. Normally you're on planes and traveling and you're just kind of keeping up with day to day. So I think this is actually a really good time, and, you know, time will tell, but let's set our watches here. In 2 years, 2 to 3 years from now, there's going to be some very big movements, I'll call them, in the industry, that will be not just a foothold, but will be actually, you know, have transformed the industry. And so I'll just kind of talk about a couple different ways here. So from a technology standpoint, digitization and digital transformation of operations would be, again, I think, top of the list for, you know, very clear reasons. We're all stuck at home right now. We still need to have operations run, you know, from a COVID perspective. But again, even before COVID, people want to know what's happening in manufacturing from a data perspective. They want to have more data-driven decisions. They want to be able to react quicker. And they essentially want to figure out how they can be even more efficient. That, you know, the cost pressure that's always been here never goes away. So I think digitization, although quite broad in that description, I think we're really going to see this take hold. Additive manufacturing, I also believe, is very, very much kind of ripe and mature now for it to actually be implemented. There are some, there are still some technical hurdles that the industry is overcoming, but bringing in ways of combining mechanical structures into electronic structures is really going to be revolutionized as well. And last on the technology side is artificial intelligence from a visual inspection perspective. Again, trying to be quite specific here. There's a lot of inspection in mechanical environments or in very small miniaturized environments that the human eye cannot see. Yet today we have operators and inspectors looking at things and saying they're okay. And we're now able to use with our camera technologies and AI software capabilities really meaningful ways to improve that quality and reduce defects. So those are a few of the technology areas. In terms of line manufacturing, connected factory exchange, a little bit of a focus here on IPC 2591. This is something that is, we're about 5 years into it. It's a little bit older than most people realize, but it's a way of connecting the factory. If you can't have a common data format to collect and move the data through, whether it's analytics or MES systems and different operational systems, then you can't get what you're looking for. You want it, but you can't see it. So definitely those are some things that are top of the technology opportunity list. In terms of the kind of the industry as a whole, I think that the opportunity here is what we're calling Factory of the Future. It's been called Industry 4.0, which is a little bit more hypothetical and kind of more focused on technology. Factory of the Future is really about enabling companies to solve real business problems and delivering real business value using technology where it's needed. And so we're really excited about making sure that the proper technologies that could help are implemented where they need to be and not just used for, you know, engineering sake, you know, something that's kind of neat and cool and shiny, but there's some real business value being gained there. So I think that kind of at a top level, at an industry level, that's what really, really excites me. And frankly, one of the reasons why I was, you know, so happy to join IPC earlier this year.
Yeah, when IPC was announcing your arrival, they said that some of the areas of focus that you'll be involved in is the Factory of the Future and creating standards and technical research around that. How do you see the Factory of the Future? What does our future factory, how does it look compared to what we're doing now? Are we just talking about the implementation of Industry 4.0, or is it beyond that?
Yeah, it's much more beyond that. And I ask, and you know, to your listeners as well, I'd ask the question, what do I want my factory of the future to look like? And it's not always about data and technology. Of course, that's a backbone that I just described. But I for my kids and my grandkids, I want them to have a clean planet. I want the supply chain to be sustainable. I want it to be using materials that are abundant and can be recycled with, you know, as little pollution as possible, things like that. The from a business standpoint, you know, I want to be able to have just-in-time delivery. So there's a lot of operational things from a factory of the future. I want supply continuity, disaster recovery, traceability of components, so we're not dealing with counterfeit electronics. If we're making changes, that we can invest in new facilities and know what we're getting even before we build the plant, i.e. digital twin. So the way that I look at Factory of the Future, my vision and what we're working on here at IPC is it's really kind of a combination of two things. So one is what I would call incremental technology advancements. And this harnesses everything we know today, PCBs, components, assembly processes, you know, our mature market as we know it today. there's still advancements, lots of things in HDI via technology, for example, and PCBs. There's always kind of an incremental advancement in those types of technologies. And then there's what I would categorize disruptive technologies. These are all the buzzwords we know very well, artificial intelligence, big data, so on and so forth. So it's one of the reasons, and we've been very careful to name the initiative Factory of the Future, is that it allows us to modernize the supply chain and factories wrapped around solving the actual business problem at hand. And if that is bringing in technology, then use it. If it's improving quality systems, and there's lots and lots of great engineering infrastructure out there, statistical process control, quality management, all of these types of notions, then resurrect and use those too. So it's not really just about adding monitors to our lines and making everything look all digital and getting it onto networks and servers. It's really all-encompassing, and if we do this over a longer period in time, you know, call it 10 or 15 years, then we've essentially allowed, for example, North American companies to be more resilient. Maybe we can really start to reshore some parts of the supply chain. There's really a lot of things that will come out of keeping an eye on modernizing our facilities. Because the alternative is, if we just say this is a mature market and we're done and we know everything and there's going to be some incremental change here and there and that's it, then quite frankly, we might as well just go home. Right. So
we're already home anyway. We're not far to go.
That's very true. So, just some of my thoughts on that.
IPC says there's a desire to create and launch an industry CTO council. And I think that's something that you're involved in. Tell me about that.
Yeah. So it's an integral part of our strategy. So, we try to put our arms around this problem as best we can internally within our executive team. But, with any planning process, you need the statistical world, it's called VOC, Voice of the Customer. And that's essentially what the CTC Council is. It's a grouping and a collection of our industry's top technical leadership. This could be the CTO, it could be a fellow, it could be distinguished engineer, it could be a whole variety of technical leadership, but it's the people that really understand those technical aspects of their business that are willing to share what those needs are at an industry level. That said, it's always, these are sometimes difficult councils to get meaningful information out of, in the sense that when you talk technology, sometimes people don't want to share. So we're prefacing this on, there is always going to be, we'll call them business trade secrets. That's never, gone away. So we want only the things that are collective problems that really benefit. If everyone was doing the same thing, that it really benefits everybody and makes everybody's life easier. So what we're trying to do is we're bringing this group of technical leadership together to get that industry voice of what we're really needing, to modernize and to look forward.
Very good. So let's get out your crystal ball, Matt, and talk about the future a little bit. I've already talked about the fact that I think there's opportunity in this pandemic, but outside of the pandemic, I think this is an exceptionally exciting time for our electronics industry with industry 4.0, factory of the future, with Internet of Things, with the electrification of cars. I just see the electronics industry exploding. And, we haven't always gone through that cycle. We've gone through ups and downs, and now I think is a tremendous up opportunity. Where do you see our industry going? And do you see IoT as a positive thing? I'll quantify that. Sometimes I've been known to say that sometimes IoT is just silly. We're putting electronics in things just because we can, not because anyone really needs an internet-connected toothbrush, which is a real thing, by the way. Outside of the silly things, do you think that the industry is benefiting from IoT, which is largely consumer-driven, which is largely low-cost items, which is largely items that are not built to Class 3 standards, which is largely items that fail in harsh environments if they're not built to those standards? I see a lot of challenges and opportunities there. What's your take on IoT? And then we can get into cars for a little bit too.
Yeah, if I can talk a little bit about IoT, but in the industrial setting. So IIoT.
There you go.
Or the convergence of IT, OT systems. This is the backbone for Factory of the Future. Yes, I agree that we don't need a internet-connected factory toothbrush. However, from a product manufacturing standpoint, I really think that IoT is very, very useful in the manufacture of the products. And I think we should probably separate the discussion into two areas as well here too. So you can apply IoT or IIoT to how something is made. That's bucket number one. And then bucket number two is what is that product doing in the field during its life? So is that product talking, calling home, or is it allowing you to connect to the internet and providing sensor data? So I think that if you approach it with in those two areas, it really helps to narrow the discussion. So in terms of the manufacturing side of things, it's hands down. IoT is it's already here. That the trouble is that it's expensive, and there's not a lot of commonality. Enter in IPC's Connected Factory Exchange. The analogy here is, and I'll just use English just as the common language. Right now we have so many different languages out there that English isn't speaking with German, which isn't speaking with French, which isn't speaking with Mandarin. And that's the crux of the problem. If we have a common language that allows the infrastructure to talk and move either up and down or left to right, now we're talking. And then that's really kind of the easiest way that I can explain IoT in a manufacturing setting. So CFX, there's others as well that are attempting to do this and to standardize this. Once you have that backbone, watch out. You can do analytics, you can do company-to-company, you know, reporting and insights. So I think that's already on its way. We just need to have some more runtime and let that mature a little bit. Again, we're still in early years here. Mm-hmm. On the product side, I definitely agree with you. I think that, you know, there's some good IoT, and then there's just some wasted and useless IoT. On the product side, one thing I should mention, as we have more and more sensors come in the world, I mean, who knows what the real number is, but you get this, you know, there's going to be billions of sensors, you know, reporting, you know, every second in the world, right, with zettabytes of data, mind-blowing type of stuff. The one thing that is also emerging is how do you power that? And so things like energy harvesting at the sensor level is really important. I mean, battery powering this stuff is not feasible. So it starts to, the IoT side of, on the product side, is also now creating some new opportunities, like for example, power that I've just mentioned. So, you know, to summarize this one, I think that IoT is good, but it really depends on how you're using it.
Sure. It's like the internet. You know, the internet is an extremely valuable tool, and it also has a lot of stuff on it that you don't want to look at. So you get both. With any good technology, you get you know, you get exploits in both directions. Let's talk about cars for a minute before we finish up. The electrification of cars obviously is a big deal. And I look at car companies two ways. I look at companies like Tesla, which is really a tech company building cars. And then I look at GM and Ford and all the other usual suspects, which are really car companies, including tech. There are pros and cons to each strategy, and there have been plenty of editorial criticisms of each strategy. But when it comes to car companies, including tech, how are they coming into our industry as a car company, which is, you know, a mechanical company, and are there unique standards, IPC standards and others, that are specifically for the automobile market? You know, the cars now, from what I read, are 30 to 50% of their bill of materials are electronics. You know, you'd think it would be metal and other things, but it's electronics now. And the electronics in cars have gone from infotainment and, you know, curious capabilities, seat massagers and whatever, to things that keep us alive, things that cannot fail, you know, clearly class three, maybe even higher in some cases. How are the car companies embracing IPC standards, if they are, or are standards being created that are unique to the automotive industry, just like there were for space applications? What's your take and knowledge of that area?
This is a really exciting area, I agree. One thing that we've already done and we continue to build, and I'd just like to highlight the work that some of my colleagues have done. So Sanjay Huprakar, our Vice President of Solutions, Tracy Regan, Director of Business Development here at IPC, along with myself and others. Step one, we've spent a lot of time this last calendar year and quite frankly the last 3 to 4 years collaborating and improving that collaboration with auto manufacturers, whether they're the OEMs or the automotive suppliers, like Bosch, Continental, for example, and then the OEMs, Ford, Toyota, Volkswagen, BMW, Mercedes. So we've been working very closely with all those groups, but also at an industry level, we issued a press release just a few weeks ago on our MOU with AIAG. So we're getting a lot more involved in the automotive sector, specifically in Europe, I would say, at this moment. And what it's really doing is getting at kind of the heart of your question is what needs to be done from an electromechanical design and manufacturing perspective. You know, putting mechanical things with electronics, we know that's one of the most dangerous things. It creates smoke and burn events and all kinds of bad things, harsh environments. So we're absolutely hooked in and connected with the automotive associations and that supply chain. So that's step number one. And then as we get into there, now we can start to talk about the details. So for example, we've got IPC 6012, which is the automotive addendum portion. Again, very specific on the needs and wants of the automotive sector. And we also have an automotive addendum in the IPC A 610 document as well. So the electrification or the autonomous vehicles, I mean, we don't have to look very far to realize the amount of work that's happening in these areas, but we're absolutely committed to understanding those needs and making sure that we can take the strengths that IPC already has and the members of how we know how to build things electronically and apply those to these types of environments.
Excellent. Well, I think with that, we'll wrap up. I really, Matt, appreciate you being on this program, and I really appreciate your insight. I'm very pleased that you're with IPC from a selfish standpoint, because I think IBM shouldn't be the benefactor of all of your knowledge. It's nice to see your experience and your knowledge shared with our industry. And I think that was a really good move. And I wish you a lot of success as chief technologist of IPC. I don't think I need to wish that. I think you're going to have a lot of success anyway. But I do wish you all the best there. I do agree with your assessment that there is a lot of opportunities right now, even in light of the global pandemic. Hopefully we'll see some of those opportunities more vividly, and we'll be able to be ready for this pandemic to be over stronger as an industry than we were before it went in, and certainly wiser. I think that's kind of a predetermined outcome.
Thanks for having me, Mike. I really appreciate the time and the opportunity to share some of my thoughts with you. So thank you.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for joining me, Matt. Well, that's another episode. Thanks for listening to the Reliability Matters podcast. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe to Reliability Matters on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, or wherever you get your podcasts. A special thanks to Circuits Assembly Magazine and Ascendo Reliability for syndicating this show, and where you can listen to this and other interesting podcasts on PCBChat.com and Reliability.fm. Thanks for your questions and episode suggestions. Please keep them coming. Send comments to mike@mikeconrad.com. That's Conrad with a K. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another episode of Reliability Matters. Once again, thanks for listening, and keep doing it right.
Thanks for listening to the Reliability Matters podcast. Join us on the second and fourth Tuesday of each month for new episodes of Reliability Matters.